Anyway, welcome back. I think our presentation last month was excellent, a lot to think about on mental health. And tonight, we switch over to a different topic. But before we start that, I just want to mention a few things. One, you know, to keep in our prayers the people in Florida and Southeast states, a lot of our Ashton's family come from those areas. So I want to keep that mindful of them. And then also I wanted to mention a couple of people that are usually with us on these Thursdays have died. One is Maria Morandini, who's from the West Coast, Sierra Madre. She was associated with our retreat center, Sierra Madre, in LA area. Very generous woman, very good woman.
She lives in Mesquite, Nevada.
She lives in Nevada now, yeah.
Mesquite, yeah.
Yeah, and then Sister Joanne Faraday. She was always on Thursday, but a passionate sister from out east who did a lot of ministry with the eastern province down in the Jamaica, West Indies, and Mandeville, and Shrewsbury, etc. A lot of things. So I think people out east are probably more familiar with her, but she died just last week unexpectedly. So we keep them in prayers also. So tonight we're going to talk to Stephen about if we could just reflect upon the elections coming up, not specifically, but just in generally, how our faith informs us about the responsibility we have to vote, what that means in a theological sense. We're not getting into ideologies, but just something to help us. And then I had sent Steve a copy of that notice from the Solidarity Committee, and they started reminding us of the Passionist Charism and our call to think of others, be responsible, especially for those who are forgotten, etc., and what that has to inform us about politics as well. So I think, Steve, it's just a great time. I'm glad you're able to be with us. He's been on a sabbatical, and so he's very gracious in giving us this time as he's working on other projects away from his teaching schedule. So, Steve, I'll begin with a prayer. We have our general chapter going on this month for about 3 weeks. And so I'd like to use a prayer from the general chapter, remembering them and their discernment during these several days. So I'll see if I can bring it up on screen. I'll read it, but I wanted to bring it up on screen so at least you could see it. Okay, do you have visual contact with the prayer? Okay, so I'll read it and then we can all end it at the end there. So let us be mindful we're in the presence of God. Let us be mindful that God is with us in all times, all places. So, merciful God, you gifted St. Paul of the Cross, our Father, a special charism by which he could see in the passion of your Son the most marvelous work of your love. Help us, his sons and daughters, to capture this love in our own lives of prayer, penance, solitude, and poverty. By being filled with and strengthened by this love, may the words and deeds of our proclamation of the gospel of the Passion be heard throughout the world. May we keep the memory of his Passion alive in our hearts for all people. Grant your Spirit to the participants of the 48th General Chapter of our congregation, so that remaining faithful to the spiritual patrimony of our Founder, they may find the pathways to a renewal of our mission in the Church and in the world. St. Paul of the Cross, pray for us. So, Steve, I'm going to... Okay. Now, I would remind you again, you know, up on the right side, top side, under view, if you do speaker view, it lets you see the speaker in a larger screen, if that's, it seems more comfortable doing it that way. So, Steve, do you want to go ahead?
Sure. Thanks very much. Thanks very much, Don, for putting this together and for having me back. Thank you to the Passionist community. It's good to be with all of you. Thank all of you for turning out tonight to hear a little bit about this. Indeed, my wife has been joking with me that I, as a person who thinks professionally about Catholicism and public life, taking a sabbatical during the fall 2024 semester might not have been the smartest decision I could have made. It has not promoted my rest and my attention to other things in the way that perhaps I might have hoped that it would. But nevertheless, I try to do as much speaking about what I'll talk to you about tonight as I can, because I think obviously every election is important. Every moment in our public life is important. But I think for a variety of reasons I'll talk about here tonight, we're in an unusual situation in 2024, something worth reflecting on. And I think back a lot on something Pope Francis has said a couple of times, that we are not living in an era of changes, we are living in a change of eras. We are sitting on the fulcrum right now, between one period of time and another period of time. And so it's, I think, very important to be attentive to that. What the next era looks like, really, I think, will in no small part hinge on us and how attentive we are to what we believe and how we behave in this world that has been given to us to earn our salvation, but to earn our salvation together with and for one another. As I often say, as I said in a Q&A up at Marquette University just the other day in response to a question, someone asked me, why worry so much about politics? Why worry so much about the world and public life? Isn't this really all about our salvation? I always like to remind people that the world is not beside the point of creation. We are here for this. And so this is important, perhaps in our lifetimes, never more important than now. So with that as preliminary, let me begin by saying that there's a great temptation when one talks about navigating our engagement with political life, with public life. There's a great temptation always to talk about issues. And I want to begin here tonight by saying I, in fact, will not be able to fully avoid talking about issues myself by the time we're over. But I want to begin tonight by saying that any discussion of issues inevitably has the effect of foregrounding or prioritizing the issues that we talk about. There's a danger, I'm saying, in an issue-focused engagement with politics and our public life, because our attention will always be fixed on the issues that someone like me identifies. But the reality is, and I'll discuss a little bit about this before we're finished here tonight, there are so many issues. It's not just the ones that we think about. And the ones that seem most important from where I am sitting might not be the ones that seem most important from where you are sitting. And so I want to begin by saying that this, I think, for a long time, we have had these voters' guides or the Faithful Citizenship Document from the bishops, but all kinds of other organizations try to help Catholics navigate these decisions that we have to make by offering voters' guides. But I'm saying this is the problem with the voters' guide approach, because the voters' guide inevitably is going to be a list of issues and it's going to identify a list of issue positions. But our behavior as citizens, as much as our lives as believers, those things are contextual and they are particular. Politics is always particular. And we all live within the horizon of our own position socially, historically, experientially, phenomenally. And we all therefore prioritize the issues and identify the issues that engage us that seem important. Inevitably, we only prioritize those issues ourselves from where we ourselves begin. In other words, we only have our own perspective in history. None of us has the whole perspective. It's quite common in these voter guide that I'm talking about, it's quite common to begin actually, if we're going to talk about issues, to begin from the perspective of moral theology that gives priority to particular ethical problems or particular threats to human life. According to their particular gravity. This was something that Cardinal Bernardin, in his exposition of the consistent ethic of life, spent a lot of time thinking about the relative gravity of particular issues, particular threats. And yet, I want to say this approach also, I think, is a little bit problematic when we approach the challenge of voting. Because when we begin from a list of moral problems, euthanasia or poverty or whatever, we're beginning from abstraction. We're not beginning from concrete, particular situations. We're beginning from abstraction. And when we begin from abstraction, I think very often we miss that particularity, that horizon in which each of us lives. We miss that most critical dimension of what political life is. Politics, as I say, is particular. Our own situations are unique to where we find ourselves in history. And it's also the case that when we begin from that list of prioritized threats to human life that we might find in a voter's guide that cites to moral theology, it's also the case, I think, that that tends to distort our engagement with issues and with the challenges that we face. Because the simple fact is, and here I speak as a political scientist, we don't always have the opportunity to be effective practically on the most grave moral questions. In other words, there may be especially grave threats to human life that are beyond the reach of our ballot because of the landscape of possibilities that are in front of us today, because of how we understand our own potential for effectiveness. So we wind up overestimating or underestimating our ability to be effective because we're beginning from an abstraction rather than beginning from the particular horizon in which we begin. This distorts, I'm saying, our political behavior. And I think sometimes, too, it diverts our attention from where we can be effective. And here, because it's in the elephant in the room, whenever we talk about navigating US politics as Catholics, I'll name abortion as a particular example across the last 50 years when we have been told that this is among the gravest threats to human life, and it is. And so that means that we must vote in a particular way because of abortion, even though throughout the last 50 years, after Roe versus Wade, as a matter of constitutional law, abortion was removed from the purview of the executive or of the legislative branches. It was beyond the reach of the ballot in 1976 and 1980 and 1984 and 1988 and 1992 and 1996 and 2000 and 2004 and 2008 and 2012. It was simply beyond the reach of the ballot. Our vote didn't do anything. And even while we were not being effective, perhaps somewhat worse, we weren't thinking about other more proximate threats to human life, things that we might have been more effective about had we thought about those things during that period of time. As a political scientist, I can say we've overlooked a lot of characteristics of voter behavior that political science study. While we began with a list of grave moral evils that was somewhat abstract, that was not linked to the concrete horizon surrounding us, theologically, I would say too, I think that doing that took judgment, particularly prudence and prudential judgment, out of its proper place in our political decision making. We lost sight of particularity, we lost sight of context, and we abandoned our own capacity for judgment within the horizon of possibility where we each find ourselves historically. So it's for that reason that I think we want to begin here tonight by noticing that simply beginning with issues is loaded with problems. It restricts the range of our conversation that might exclude things that I highlight, but are within your horizon. But the other thing I would say too, is that even as we have been sort of locked in these abortion politics across the last 50 years or so, one thing we certainly can say is that since the Dobbs decision in 2022, we Catholics engaging political life in the United States have an opportunity for something like a reset. Or perhaps we can say we have an opportunity to sort of push back a little bit from the table and take stock, because we are in a different moment. We're in a different situation now, legally, constitutionally, politically, socially, because of the Dobbs decision. It's an opportunity, I think, to do two things. One thing is to look back in that way that I sort of just have and ask some sobering questions about whether all of this effort that we have expended across the last 50 years, whether that has gotten us the outcomes that we wanted. And there I tend to think the answer is no. But the other opportunity that we have is an opportunity to take stock from where we are today and ask the question about our public engagement in a new way, in a fresh way that begins from where we are. In a way, I will add that the Faithful Citizenship Document from the bishops really doesn't. If you don't know, that document was written in 2007 and has not been revised since George W. Bush was president and Benedict XVI was pope. We're in a moment here where we have an opportunity to step back and ask the question in a fresh way, how should we engage with public life and politics here in the United States? And as we do that, I would make this observation. And the observation simply is this, that what we have now is the first presidential race since 1972, at least, where abortion is really not on the presidential ballot in any way at all, not even theoretically. And in fact, I would say there isn't all that much difference between the positions of the two parties and the two nominees at this point. The Democrats' position on that issue hasn't changed at all. If anything, their position has intensified. The Republicans don't even mention that issue in their platform. Their nominee wants to leave it to the states. We hear sometimes about possible congressional actions that might result from this election, a national abortion ban to the one side, or codifying Roe versus Wade and federal law to the other side. But I tend to discount a lot of that talk, mostly because it would depend on one-party control of both chambers of Congress and the White House, a fairly unusual situation that I'm not sure is in the cards for us. Like a lot of things, I think that talk is really about energizing the base in one party or the other for an election year. There's nothing official in the statements of the parties or the candidates that tells us that our vote would change anything on that issue. And I would even go so far as to put it this way, that if you look at the Republicans under Donald Trump and the Democrats under Kamala Harris, the difference between their positions on abortion is very much like the difference between a glass of water that's half full and a glass of water that's half empty. Both candidates, both platforms simply offer us different ways of keeping abortion legal. And in a strange sort of way, admitting that that was hardly the outcome 50 years of our engagement with public life has sought. But in a strange sort of way, I want to suggest that that's actually a liberating opportunity. because it offers us an opportunity in this way that I've been mentioning to approach the whole question of our political engagement in a fresh way. Dobbs has given us that opportunity to step back from the divisive, binary abortion polarizing politics of the last 50 years and to begin afresh. That's what I'm encouraging us to do. And as we do that, the right place, I think, to begin is with a consistent ethic of life. And this is the subject that I have spent a considerable amount of time this fall talking about. I have a book on the consistent ethic of life that came out late in the spring, and I wrote it. Very honestly, I wrote it for this election. It's about 100 pages long. I wrote it for parishes and for classrooms, for ordinary readers everywhere, because I knew at the time when I was writing it that we were going to be in this new moment after Dobbs. And I also was pretty sure the U.S. bishops were still not going to revise faithful citizenship. I had a strong feeling that Catholic voters in this moment were entitled to a resource that was engaged with where we are now. And that's what the book is. And yet, even as I say that the book and its description of a consistent ethic of life is engaged with where we are now, I hope I'm not telling anyone something new, something they didn't know already, when I say that the consistent ethic itself is not new at all. The consistent ethic has been here for a very long time. But this again points to one of the reasons why I wrote the book. The consistent ethic, as soon as Cardinal Bernardine proposed it in 1983, became controversial itself. And I'll say a word about that. Pardon me. I'll say a word about that too. But the consistent ethic became controversial. It's been distorted. It's been misrepresented. It has been frustrated in the most important thing Cardinal Bernardine wanted it to do, to disrupt our partisan instincts, to disrupt this way that we surrender ourselves to this binary between one side or the other. Cardinal Bernardine very much hoped that we could resist that temptation to think of ourselves as Democrats or Republicans or liberals or conservatives or progressives or whatever. And rather than all of that, think of ourselves in a consistent way, first of all, as Catholic voters. That's what the consistent ethic does. That's what Cardinal Bernardine wanted it to do. That has been lost, I think, across the last 40 years, as the consistent ethic fell into controversy almost the moment Cardinal Bernardine proposed it. But for all the reasons I've been talking about, that's why I have also felt sort of strongly that we are in a moment where the recovery of the consistent ethic is well timed. We need a new engagement, a new look. We need to take a close look today at the consistent ethic of life. It was proposed first by Cardinal Bernardine of Chicago in 1983 in a lecture that he gave at Fordham University. The ethic itself actually has even deeper roots in the war in Vietnam, as well as in the Second Vatican Council. Immediately in 1983, when Cardinal Bernardine proposed it in December of 1983, it came on the heels of the bishop's pastoral letter, The Challenge of Peace, which engaged the nuclear arms buildup and the threat of nuclear war that probably all of us on this call are old enough to remember. Even I am old enough to remember, very much troubled us in the early 1980s in a way it hadn't really since the Cuban Missile Crisis. The bishops, in writing the Challenge of Peace, engaged the nuclear issue from a military point of view, from a point of view of physics, from a point of view of public health, from a point of view of geopolitics. They took an all-encompassing view of the problem. Cardinal Bernardine talked about how much he really learned about the nuclear strategy of the United States in the course of doing the research to write what was a very long, detailed engagement for a pastoral letter, but an important document that came out in May of 1983. But as he came out of that experience, Cardinal Bernardine had a moment of wondering at a time when also the abortion politics after Roe versus Wade, this is now 10 years after Roe, the abortion politics were reaching their mature point and our division over that issue between the two parties had become very clear. Cardinal Bernardine found himself wondering after the challenge of peace, a very simple question that we might reflect on for a moment, which is let us assume a world exists in which abortion has ended, there are no abortions, every child, every pregnancy is carried to term, every child is born into the world. But what good would all of that do? Cardinal Bernardine wondered if that child were born into a world that could be annihilated 5 minutes later by a global nuclear exchange. I think that that question takes us right to the heart of why we think in terms of a consistent ethic of life. Because among the many things it calls to our attention, I think the most important of them is that we can't neatly disentangle the various threats to human life. We can't just pull them apart. When we are talking about one human life, we are talking about all of us face all sorts of challenges, all sorts of threats, all sorts of things that might frustrate our dignity or our flourishing. In the end, it is not, as I've been saying since the beginning, it's not really about issues. In the end, it's about the human person. And it's about seeing the human person as the center of our concern. But that's not simple. And that's not something that we can itemize in a list. It's complex and it requires a different sort of engagement. As I'm saying, Cardinal Bernardine was troubled by the way in which our partisan instincts were being sharpened into this polarized binary that has become so familiar to us. What troubled him certainly was the way in which Catholics were certainly pro-life and engaged in the political struggle against abortion by the mid-1980s, but also because of their affiliation with the Republican Party, because of their opposition to abortion, Catholics were also quite supportive of the Reagan administration's arms buildup. This was also an inspiration behind the consistent ethic of life, because in fact, Cardinal Bernardine, and I think we can agree, most of us, I think, would agree that that is a rather inconsistent moral expression. To say, on the one hand, we are opposed to abortion because we believe in the dignity and the flourishing of every human life, and yet we will entertain the exchange of nuclear weapons. We will commit our resources to building these weapons that, if they ever were used, would have horrendous consequences for every living human being on Earth. The inconsistency of that position was what motivated Cardinal Bernardine. And so the consistent ethic of life became a way to, as I say, call us away from those partisan commitments and ask us to engage the problems that are in front of us as believers and citizens, to engage them first in the light of the gospel and in a way that is consistent. This actually, as I say, and you can find this history in chapter one of the book, and it's actually quite interesting. I learned quite a lot about doing it. The real roots of this were in the Vietnam War. Archbishop Umberto Medeiros of Boston was troubled in 1971 in much the same way that Cardinal Bernardine was in 1973 by the perplexing contradiction of Catholics who were opposed to abortion but also supporting the war in Vietnam. And it was Archbishop Medeiros in 1971 who gave us the phrase a consistent ethic in a July 4th homily that he gave that year. I want to add too that, a lot of folks ask about the seamless garment and how that relates to this. The phrase comes from a different origin. Eileen Egan began talking about a seamless garment in 1970, about the same time as Archbishop Medeiros's homily. But those two began from different origins. They converged in Cardinal Bernardine's discussion of the consistent ethic of 1983. For all intents and purposes, the seamless garment and the consistent ethic refer to the same thing. They refer to this call to us to be consistent in how we approach the challenges that we face, but also to recognize that the threats to human life are not so neatly disentangled. Like the cloak that is cut from whole cloth, we can't pull it apart. Everything is connected to everything else in the lives of particular human beings. That's very important. But I will say too that the real origin of the consistent ethic is found in the Second Vatican Council's Pastoral Constitution on the Church in the Modern World, Gaudium et Spes. At paragraph 27, it says this, and I'd like to read the whole quote. I'll tell you why in a moment. But this is from the Pastoral Constitution on the Church in the Modern World. Whatever is opposed to life itself, such as any type of murder, genocide, abortion, euthanasia, or willful self-destruction, whatever violates the integrity of the human person, such as mutilation, torments inflicted on body or mind, attempts to coerce the will itself, whatever insults human dignity, such as subhuman living conditions, arbitrary imprisonment, deportation, slavery, prostitution, the selling of women and children, as well as disgraceful working conditions, where people are treated as mere tools for profit rather than as free and responsible persons, all these things, and others of their like, are infamies. They poison human society, but they do more harm to those who practice them and those than those who suffer from the injury. Moreover, they are a supreme dishonor to the Creator. And I think that quotation is important because it highlights this feature of the consistent ethic that I've been talking about. There is no sense when I read this passage of one threat to human life or human flourishing being more important or prioritized over another. And indeed, there's something quite open-ended about that list and others of their kind. There is, I think, whenever I read this, and I've read it many times, I've read it aloud in class many times, for me, there is a sense of the interconnectedness of all of these things, because again, what we are doing is we are putting the human person at the center of our concern, and we are focusing on that person and all of the ways in which that person is encountering challenges, threats, is made vulnerable, is pushed to the peripheries. That's the center of our concern. Not a list of issues, but rather whatever dishonors the Creator. And what dishonors the Creator is any way in which we treat what has been created and what is has been saved and what is loved by God. That is to say, every human person and everything in creation, when we treat that like it's disposable, when we treat something the Creator has given us like it doesn't matter, this is a dishonor to the Creator. That's the heart of the consistent ethic of life. Anything that threatens the human person is a dishonor to the Creator. It's an infamy. And it is very difficult once we recognize how interrelated these things become in the experience of our lives. It's very hard to rank or prioritize them. The priority, in fact, is the person. Here, I come now to what I feel like is an obligation. I've told you several times what the consistent ethic is not. It's not a voter's guide. It's not a list of issues. It doesn't give priority to one issue or another. But here I feel an obligation to tell you what the consistent ethic is. And even as I feel that obligation, I have to tell you that's a very challenging thing to do. Because, and if you've been listening, if you've been following along here, I think perhaps you understand why. The consistent ethic doesn't, in fact, tell me exactly how to vote. The consistent ethic of life does not tell me what issue is most important. It doesn't tell me good, bad, good, evil. It doesn't do any of that. What the consistent ethic does, though, is it asks me to reflect in a way that is morally serious, that is committed, and is focused first on the call of our baptism to live out the gospel. The consistent ethic is very well suited, I'm saying, to particularity and to complexity, because it is a thing that each of us does in the forum of our own conscience, in the silence of our own prayer. Within our own experience, we ask ourselves, I often talk when I talk about this, about the parable of the Good Samaritan. It's not the abstract vulnerable person that I have to think about how I can help. It is the beaten man in front of me lying on the side of the road who commands my attention. Where, when I focus on the call of my baptism to live out the gospel in that way, where can I do the most effective good? That's the question of the consistent ethic of life. Cardinal Bernardine often described the consistent ethic as an attitude or as a posture. And we might say that the consistent ethic is an approach. But I prefer to put it the way that one of his theologians that he worked with on the consistent ethic likes to describe it. The consistent ethic is a call to spiritual conversion. It's a call to renew our commitment to our baptism and to do it in an engaged way every election, every time we vote, but also in all the time in between. To be attentive to our citizenship as the opportunity to help the beaten person lying on the side of the road, always asking, where can my vote, where can my concrete action from within the horizon of my own experience do the most good? But above all, to ask that question honestly, We have to overcome our partisan instincts. We have to overcome the tendency to think of ourselves as belonging to one party or the other. Rather, we approach our decisions by beginning from a converted desire to be consistent, to live our lives according to the gospel as its effective witnesses, to do what we can to promote the things that Catholic social teaching tells us are the right objects of our attention in social life, to pay attention to our moral responsibilities and be attentive to human life itself. And in that way, because it's so particular and because it happens in the forum of my own conscience and in the forum of your own conscience, the consistent ethic can't offer us the specifics of a voter's guide. It can't give us the easy answer. Here's what the good Catholic will do at the ballot box. It's not a list of issue positions. It is rather a call to reflect spiritually on moral actions. It is particular, it is contextual, it is individual. And because of that, we all can make different decisions because we read the landscape differently, because we stand in a different perspective toward the landscape, because we understand the possibilities of our effective action differently. This was what I was talking about a bit ago when I talked about the ways in which political scientists study voter behavior. When you really drill into how voters make decisions, it is really nothing like what we find in the voters' guides, unless the voters are handing their decision-making off to the voters' guides. What we all do is we look to our experience and we look to what we believe and we try to make the best moral judgment that we can make, which might mean that I might vote for one party this time and the other party next time. It might mean that I even surprise myself with what my reflection leads me to. I was giving this talk up in one of the parishes in the northern suburbs here a couple of months ago, and a man got up and actually volunteered. It was his opposition to abortion that led him to oppose the death penalty. He had done exactly what the consistent ethic asks him to do, and he had surprised himself, because his own spiritual dedication to asking these questions in this way had led him to an outcome he didn't expect. That's wonderful. That means there's spiritual growth underway. It also doesn't necessarily mean that he's found the right answer, because we are meant to continue reflecting on this every day and from election to election to election. All of those things describe, I think, in a sort of a way of a constellation, what the consistent ethic is. But I think that that constellation, that arrangement of stars, corresponds quite well to what I read out to you from Gaudium et Spes. It's what the church is telling us, and it's taking seriously the way that we live our lives in these advanced modern constitutional states that we live in, where we have access to all of this information. We have access to everything that the church teaches us. But finally, in the end, we each also are decision makers. I'd want to mention briefly that the consistent ethic, in addition to finding its authority in Gaudium et Spes, find its authority in a couple of other places as well, in a way that entitles me to say that the consistent ethic is the authoritative teaching of the Roman Catholic Church. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops claim a consistent ethic of life as their framework for those faithful citizenship documents, even as I think they don't reflect the consistent ethic as well as perhaps they used to. But it is nevertheless the case that it is the claimed framework of those documents. At paragraph 40 of that most recent one from 2007, the bishops write, "The consistent ethic of life provides a moral framework for principled Catholic engagement in political life, and rightly understood, neither treats all issues as morally equivalent, nor reduces Catholic teaching to one or two issues." That's actually a really good sentence. But even more importantly, the consistent ethic was accepted into the papal magisterium by Pope John Paul II in paragraph 87 of his 1995 encyclical, The Gospel of Life, where he wrote, "Where life is involved, the service of charity must be profoundly consistent. It can't tolerate bias and discrimination, for human life is sacred and inviolable at every stage and in every situation. It is an indivisible good. We need then to show care for all life and for the life of everyone." And here again, Pope John Paul is not talking about issues. He's placing the human person at the center of concern. That's where our focus should lie. And we should be asking the questions about how we can help vulnerable human persons most effectively. I mean to say, there can be no doubting that this is exactly what the church is asking us to do. But even as I say that, I do want to think a little bit about how challenging that can be. It's all well and good to say that we can go to the forum of our own conscience and try to sort it out ourselves, but I think concretely we know that's actually quite difficult. There's no definitively Catholic way to vote except to approach the matter this way. But think about what that complexity looks like. Just think, as I said before, I can't avoid issues entirely. Think about the constellation of issues that's in front of us right now. To again name the elephant in the room, abortion hasn't gone away, and there is quite a lot of conversation about reproductive rights, or what we would call, or what we might prefer to say, is care for the unborn. But in fact, abortions are up since the Dobbs decision, as we know. Should that govern our voting? Should that command our attention when we go to the ballot box? Maybe. But at the same time, there have been thousands of innocent deaths in Gaza and throughout the Middle East, and those lives are no less innocent. They demand the same level of our concern. And we also would not want to overlook that the lives of innocent Israelis also demand our attention. And so we need to keep peace in that region very high in our concern and our attention. But then also there have been thousands of innocent deaths in Ukraine. And there, the candidates are divided about how that conflict should be resolved, whether to favor the invader or the invaded country. But then again, also, there are migrants fleeing intolerable conditions all around the world. But here in the U.S., we receive them and greet them, especially from places like Haiti or Mexico or Venezuela and others as well. Shall we welcome those strangers and recognize their dignity and their needs and offer them some comfort? Or shall we turn them away and add to their oppression? Or there are even bread and butter kitchen table issues like whether to renew the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that will expire after the election. Should we restore tax benefits to middle-class voters? Or should we continue giving breaks to the wealthiest taxpayers? That's a valid question as well, because it bears on the possibilities that people encounter in how they live their lives. And even just naming those five issues, I'll say again, I'm obviously in danger of over-prioritizing them, because there is a far wider horizon of other things that could engage our concern. And all of those issues, so far as they affect the flourishing and dignity of any human life, they matter. How do we possibly choose where to begin? And even if we could figure out which issue is most important, then we face the even thornier question of, well, then what is the effective action that will achieve the outcome that we want on the issues that we think are most important? But all of that points back to my most essential point here. Issue lists won't help us. Voters' guides aren't going to give us what we need. But there are all sorts of Catholic ways to vote, because in the end, our voting and our political engagement aren't about getting the right answer, because we are never going to settle the question of justice in the world on this side of the eschaton. The world will continue to be an imperfect and unjust place. The question for the believer, I'm saying, if we begin from our conscience and from a converted and morally serious desire to be consistent with the gospel, if we choose our action that way, we're not always going to get everything that we want. The world is not going to conform to our hopes or expectations. As Pope Francis has reminded us recently, we are always choosing the lesser of two evils. That's in the nature of every ballot that's ever been put in front of us. But if we begin that way, if we take that morally serious and consistent approach and try to do the most effective thing we can do to help the vulnerable, as best as we can see it from within our own horizon of experience, then we are not acting wrongly. Then we are pursuing a consistent ethic of life as best as any of us can see it and can find our way to it. But with all that said, let me conclude with just one last thought. And that thought, and this is purely editorial, but I'm speaking now as a political scientist as I think about the election. One last thing, another reason I don't think issues guides or voters guides will help us very much in 2024 is because I don't think this is an issues election. This isn't an election where one position or another position on tax policy is really, really the question in front of us. Since 2017, and especially since January 6, 2021, there are in fact bigger, more fundamental questions that are in front of us right now. Most of the elections that we have experienced in our lifetimes have prepared us to think about a range of issues with this answer or that answer, different issue positions that distinguish candidates and parties. What's really in front of us in this election, I would say, is politics itself, is the possibility of politics being the way that we resolve the conflicts that arise inevitably in social life. Politics, our constitutional system, the rule of law, accepting the outcomes of elections, accepting judicial findings, accepting the basic facts about our public life. No one is creating hurricanes. No one is eating pets. Accepting those basic facts and accepting the outcomes of our political system, those are much bigger questions than any issue. And they are things about which I think I can say they are things that aren't two-sided. They're not about picking which side is right and which side is wrong, because one side is clearly right and one side is clearly wrong. And that's not up for debate. Truth is right. What is opposite of truth is wrong. And politics, in this way that I'm talking about, politics, not in the sense of partisanship, in the sense of the left versus the right, the way we usually use the word, but politics in its original meaning, politics in the way Pope Francis uses the word, politics as the way we as a human community come together from a shared commitment to find the common good together, to engage in discussion together about how we're going to achieve the common good, and to compromise with one another. Because in no free system of government should anyone ever get everything they want. You give a little ground, I give a little ground, and we come together, we pursue the common good. That's what politics is. And what they will tell you, what I would tell you, in any Politics 100 course at any university in the United States, is that when conflicts arise in our social life, politics is how we address those conflicts. Politics is the alternative to violence. Politics is the alternative to violence, because where we don't discuss, where we don't pursue the common good from a shared sense of wanting to find the common good together, where we won't do that, violence is all that's left. Whatever threatens politics then in that way puts us on a road to violence. And we saw a hint of that on January 6, 2021. Whatever leaves violence as our only alternative, whatever is destructive to politics, whatever leaves violence as our only alternative is a grave threat to life, because it not only threatens our safety in the social climate where we find ourselves, but we are unable to come to agreement about how to aid the dignity and the flourishing of every human life through a political process if we are engaged in violence rather than politics. The political system itself is how we bear witness to human life. And if the political system is under threat, then it seems to me that that is a much more fundamental issue. I hope very much that we will come back to having issues elections very soon. Certainly, I hope we'll do it in my lifetime, if not by 2028. But my judgment as a political scientist is that's not the election that we're in right now. The election that we're in right now is really about whether we will allow our political system to resolve our conflicts. And if we won't, history tells us there's only one other alternative. I can't conjure in my imagination a greater threat to human life than that is. I would never tell anyone how to vote, but if I'm asked what I think, that's my most pointed moral and political analysis of the situation. Each of us has to, I think, address those questions in the forum of our own conscience, from the horizon of our own experience, and ask the question, what is the gospel asking from me? How can I be consistent? How can I bear witness to the dignity and flourishing of every human life? No matter what way we do that, let me conclude by saying, we're not acting wrongly, but we have to be open to the possibility that the answers will surprise us this time and next time, and on into the future. Politics is open-ended. Politics goes on. And so we go on in our quest for conversion, in our quest for the common good. We go on reflecting on these things in these ways that I've talked about, hopefully together coming to peaceful solutions that promote the dignity and the flourishing of every one of us. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thank you. Steve, for the comments. I think you put things in a context, somewhat of a different context than I've been thinking. So I appreciate your presentation, and we'll have time to talk about it then.
Go ahead.
Steve, our offices are next to each other, so I could ask you this tomorrow, but as a priest who preaches in a parish every Sunday, in a diverse parish, what's the best thing a priest could do in preaching in the month of November?
Probably stick to the readings.
Talk about Thanksgiving.
No, it's a really good question, and I'm so glad that I don't have to answer it in my ministerial life. I'm not really sure that I've never been a fan, even in quieter times, of a lot of preaching about the election from the altar, because I think it tends one way or the other to reinforce the message that the church has a preferred way that we should be voting. I think when we're gathered for word and for sacrament, we're gathered for word and for sacrament. The problem we have, and this is why my answer isn't a good one, the problem we have is, especially because our Catholic lives are so suburbanized at this point, the parish life is very rarely integrated into our lives in the way that it used to be. Spiritual life as a community is only comes together around the altar. My answer is a bad one, because then we don't have a lot of other opportunities to give people the opportunity to sort through these problems together. I think what I would say, Robin, my best answer to your very good question is, I don't think it's an October and November problem. I think it's a parish problem between elections, that we should be trying to find ways to form people's consciences and dispose them to a morally serious spiritual reflection when the volume is a little lower and the heat is a because the goal here, in fact, is not the election. The goal here is the spiritual life. I think if we get people that way, then I think good voting behavior can only follow, because everything we're talking about here is about how the spiritual life disposes us to be better citizens. So that's my answer. Yeah, whether it makes you feel any better or not, I don't know.
Thank you, Steve. It's a very good answer. Thank you.
Jack, go ahead and unmute yourself.
I've never known Jack to mute himself.
Hey.
It's good to see you.
Likewise. Steve, when you use the image of the half glass, the glass half full, half empty, the different candidates or platforms, it strikes me, especially in the context of synod and listening and conversion, that if you're in dialogue with someone and they don't accept some of the basics that you concluded with about common good or truth, not so much as a minister, but as a baptized person, where do you go?
You passionists are a tough crowd. you put your finger on the most difficult part of being the director of the Bernadine Center in this time. And it is simply this: how do we maintain a sincere disposition toward dialogue with everyone when we are encountering people who are not committed to dialogue in the way that we are? What do we do? How do we maintain that commitment when we're, you know, alone in that commitment? And those situations, I regret to say, are a little too common. And I must say, after now years since I've come to CTU and really taken this on as a professional commitment, I've been struggling with the question you're asking. But I will tell you that in the last year, I've come around to this way of feeling about it. The goal of dialogue is the search together for truth. And truth itself is the goal. Therefore, truth is also, and a commitment to truth is part of the price of admission. In other words, if we are encountering people who are so closed-minded, and I have encountered those people, that dialogue itself is suspicious to them because all the right answers are already known and defined, then I have to say that guidance of the gospel to shake the dust from my feet and move on has become the way I feel about it. My heart and my ears are open to every person when they are ready to be in a dialogue that is committed to the truth with me. But unfortunately, and I mean unfortunately, because as I hope you know, Jack, I take this stuff very seriously. And you mentioned synodality, which I have a lot of very strong feelings about, the need that we have to listen to one another. I try very hard to listen to what's actually motivating people when they say things to me that suggest they're not committed to dialogue. I'll make an effort with everyone that I meet to try to respond to their real concerns. What I'm picking up are their actual concerns, what's motivating them. I'll try to pull them into a dialogue. I'll make an effort. But there comes a time where you have to just leave that with the Holy Spirit and move on. And keep trying with others that we meet to even go back to that person again at some later time. But I can't dialogue with a brick wall, and I can't listen to one either. It takes two human beings or a group of human beings really committed together to the truth and finding it together. Without that, we have to admit it's just not happening, much though I am loath to say it.
Thank you.
Berta in Orlando. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What is truth nowadays, unfortunately? You know, sometimes I sit with people that go into the internet, and that's where they get all their truths. And then when I come up with you know, the truth that I truly believe, because that's the way I've been brought up all my life, and I tend to read everything and try to, you know, educate myself and somehow, you know, they truly believe what they read. So it's like a block, and that's an unfortunate thing. It's like they close their minds and they have, you know, and there's no way into it. But one of the things that I truly believe, is if you treat whoever it is with respect and you listen and you say you don't agree, you know, you can keep things, you know, without violence, without anybody getting mad and upset and saying, well, you know. So the important is to listen and just to say, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't talk about this anymore because we don't seem to agree. But not get really angry.
Now, when you asked me today, from what I heard, it immediately reminded me of a document that I was reading from Father Timothy Radcliffe at the Synod you know, one of the talks that he gave, and he quoted Dorothy Day. Dorothy Day asserted that the big fight is against violence more than it is against atheism. She said, Christians, when they are seeking to defend their faith by arms, by force and violence, are like those who said to our Lord, come down from the cross. If you are the Son of God, save yourself. Substitute for atheism, Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, left-leaning, and so on. So I think it's the avoidance of violence that, you know, that's my motivation here.
I can only agree with Cardinal Desiccant Radcliffe, and with Dorothy Day for that matter. When I teach politics, and I do, I go over to Loyola and DePaul here from time to time and still do it. It helps my reflection about theology quite a lot. But when I teach politics, especially because we're living when we're living with the challenges that we have today, I put it to students that in the way that I put it to you, that politics is always a choice to avoid violence. And there are many opportunities for violence in our social life and in our public life. And violence is not only bloodshed. Violence is also that which does harm to truth. And there are all sort of subtle violences in terms of the way that truth itself has become so contestable. The way in which our relationship to information has been so transformed these last several years by the internet, so that all information has the same value now. You know, what does the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration know about hurricanes when someone else is saying that we're creating them and aiming them at red states? All of that information somehow is equally cheap in 2024. And that's a form of violence because it degrades truth. And by degrading truth, it creates opportunities to bring violence into our relationships with one another. So I only can agree there's a tremendous unity in what both of you have said. And I think that's exactly what it looks like. That's the shape of our problem. And yet I agree too, violence can't be our response. And sometimes the right thing is to just walk away or talk about something else.
Go ahead, Pat.
Thank you. you know, as a preacher, one of the things that strikes me, though, as powerless as I am, there's also a great power in believing that in some way the Holy Spirit is going to work. And so in my preaching, and I like Robin's question, I all I can do is invite people to really trust and believe that the Holy Spirit is within them and to listen. I fall back on the days when we had the COVID and all the division and all the anger. And I remember on numerous occasions in parishes where I would say to people, isn't it great that we're alive today? I don't know whether it's good, bad, or I should wear a mask, shouldn't. But all I know is that I have the opportunity to sacrifice myself in love for others. And what does that look like for you? And to trust that somehow the grace, that the Spirit is there. The Spirit can touch people, even those who are deluded by big voices on the internet and everything else. If they really go within their own hearts and listen, the Spirit has a chance to work. And we got to believe that. You know, we got to believe that.
Yeah, I agree completely with that. A former colleague of Robin's and mine, I heard him say once that far too many of us Christians, Catholics, but Christians generally, far too many of us are third person of the Trinity atheists. We don't have that kind of confidence in the Spirit that you're talking about, that God is alive and at work around us. And we are not the authors of what the road to salvation is going to look like, what the road to the eschaton is going to be. We're not the authors. We are not the drivers. We are not participating. We play our role. But I think perhaps the best role that we play is in that way that Pope Francis talks, and I think in the way that you're talking too, about accompanying people, about sometimes just simply reminding them that there is joy, that there is hope, mercy, love, justice, peace, that these things are here, and that the simple act of bearing witness to these things in how we accompany people gives the Spirit an opportunity to work on them. That's the role that we play. And so perhaps that's, you know, a better answer to Robin's question than the one that I had, is that it, in the way that we preach, in the way that we accompany people in the sacraments, in all of the things that we do, we need to be conscious of trying to find those opportunities to open the door to the Spirit rather than close the door. And the rest is up to God. It's both liberating and yet also it feels a little frightening to let go that way. But it is the case that we are not actually responsible for fixing all of it. We're just responsible for playing our part.
Steve, I just wanted to say thank you. I'm preparing talks on hope.
Talib?
Yes?
I think Kathy was raising her hand.
Yeah, if you don't mind.
Thanks.
Hi, Steve. My name's Kathy. I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. During the break, I bought your book. And there's 12 left in stock. So if anybody else, just so you know. So, thank you. I appreciate it. These past few years have been difficult for a lot of people, a lot of families, where there hasn't been much dialogue. My family personally, we have a family member who has pretty much alienated himself from us, and there hasn't been much dialogue. So thank you for what you've said tonight. It has opened up some possibilities for me. I typically am one who has to try to be in control of a lot of things, and I have to keep being reminded that I'm not. And thank you all. I thank all of you all for that. That's all.
That's wonderful. I would just say, you know, I have a cousin. We all have someone in our family. I'd stayed in dialogue with him for years, and then the day he began defending the assault on the Capitol, I don't know. At some point we have such mismatched premises that it's no longer possible. And you know, I've spoken to him now since that, and we're still talking, but I mean, I think we all have these stories, and it's terrible. It's grief. And it's violence too. There's a great comfort in exactly what you say. The letting go, the recognizing that some of this is just beyond our power to affect, and that itself is an opportunity for spiritual maturity for us. And the rest we just give over. But I'll say last, you know, they'll always print more books. So don't be too put off. Someone is in control of that. Don't be too put off about that, but thank you. Thank you very much.
And I wasn't thanking you trying to wrap it up. I was saying, thank you. You just gave me three quotes that I'm working on a talk that I'm going to be giving, and you just wrote the whole talk with me with these three quotes. So thank you.
I mean, we accompany one another. Lord knows I've stolen plenty of material from people too. This is it's all a great conversation. I'd be nowhere without Cardinal Bernadine.
So any final quotes or questions or thoughts?
I'd like to say something. Hello, good evening. I'm Patty. I'm in Sugar Land, Texas. I'm with the Passionist Group here at Holy Name Retreat Center in Houston. Given all this, I mean, this is really deep stuff for sure. Some of my thoughts were, when you think about politics, I couldn't help but think about, well, this thought of politics is the fig leaf that people use to cover themselves from really wanting to know the truth or going toward truth. And, you know, I'm in formation for spiritual direction with the Passionists, and in my second year, we're in our practicum year. So, you know, it's a form of a mask. But then when you put all this together, and I shared in my little group, you know, the world wasn't ready when Jesus Christ came on the scene and did things differently and compassionately and lovingly, and said, doesn't matter if you're a Samaritan or a Pharisee, you got to help somebody. You see him on the side of the road like the Samaritan, you know, and the world still operates that way today. They're not ready. And to me, it just all points to godlessness. That God has been taken out of the system, and everyone has become their own God. I mean, I'm not trying to offend anybody, but you know, that's how I see things. So I appreciated your reflection question here, where it said, "Would you change your mind about an issue if discernment and prayer led you there?" And I certainly would, because if I have a relationship with my higher power, God, through prayer and my sacramentality and my devotions, and I'm given a conviction of heart towards the truth, I definitely pray that I would obey and do it that way, go toward that. So there's a lot here. There's a lot here. And then the what you say here in the number three reflection question, how can you be more consistent witness to human life in your own community? Well, you know, we got to get involved. We got to listen to this with each other and not be hurt by each other's opinions and closed-minded, because if we are all in Christ, then what wrong way can we go? You know, human power is worthless considering God will prevail anyway. He's already won the victory. So anyway, that's just kind of all I wanted to say. Just I'd love coming to these things because it makes me think deeper. So anyway,
I appreciate
those are just my little thoughts. Little thoughts, but they seemed really deep.
No, they're actually quite big thoughts. You said something at the end that's very close to something I say quite often, which is that all of history, everything was decided forever on a hill outside Jerusalem 2,000 years ago. And the rest is just how it all works out, how we get there. And that's a very important perspective to keep in mind. But it enables me then to lean back on something that I said in response to an earlier question. That means we have to be attentive to our role in all of this. But it also means we have to recognize it's fine. It's what Julian of Norwich said. All shall be well and all manner of things shall be well. God was killed on a hill outside Jerusalem. It's never going to get worse than that. Everything else is going to be fine. But part of what that, of course, means too is that, and I always have a funny reaction to the idea of godlessness, because it suggests that we human beings have some sort of a power to put God out of the picture. And I think that, you know, when we recognize that the Spirit is here between us here tonight and at work in the world, we recognize godlessness isn't in the picture either. We resist, and we all resist. We all resist. And that's that condition of not being ready, as you were talking about, that was as true 2,000 years ago as it's true today. This is the dilemma of being human beings. But I think then, too, we have to have so much compassion for one another to try to recognize that that's what's going on. We each in the horizon, I was talking at the beginning about living within the horizon of our own experience. That's our tragedy, but it's also our advantage. And it gives us an opportunity to recognize that that's the condition of the other as well. And so I try to remain in dialogue with that person. I try to hear that person sympathetically. I try to listen for what that person is really trying to say to me, even if they're saying something that, you know, upsets me or is somehow awful. I stay with it and I try. And I'm going to fail too, by the way, and I certainly have failed. But we stay at it because that's the way we are asked to play this role, I think. And by playing that role together, then finally we are doing that good work of what politics is. And politics is not a thing that divides us. Politics is actually, I'm on a quest. My students would tell you, I talk about this endlessly. I'm on a quest to recover the meaning of the word politics, because politics means the community together looking for the common good. Politics doesn't mean division. And if we could remember what politics actually is a little more often, I think we'd have a better place to stand and start doing some of this work we're talking about here tonight. I got 40 minutes on that. I won't give it to you here, but I can go on about that at some length.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. This was good. And I, for lack of a better word, when you said resistance, so that was what I put down in your reflection question too, you know, there's always resistance. And so, godlessness. Yeah. I can see where it can take that. I like that. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Best wishes to you down there.
Don?
Okay. Yeah. Steve, thank you very much. I think you helped us. A deeper understanding of what it means to be a citizen and a Catholic and how they can work together, you know, or be together, and especially an understanding of politics, of what it really means. So I appreciate that. You know, in the portal where we put Steve's questions earlier, there's also a link that'll remind you of the book he wrote, Consistent Ethic of Life, which we were discussing tonight. So if you forget the title, just go into the portal under Steve's name and then go to that link. And it's a Paulus Press book. So, and then the other thing, so next month, then we have Elizabeth Johnson. Now, Elizabeth wanted to work with Robin, so I think Robin might have a little intro for us.
Yeah, November 14th, we have a very distinguished theologian, Elizabeth Johnson, with us, talking especially about her book, Come Have Breakfast, Meditations on God and the Earth. She wants to make it kind of a dialogue back and forth. I think it really will be enriching for everyone. So she's such a great speaker and a very important contemporary theologian. So join us on November 14th.
So Robin will be asking her questions for her to respond. She didn't want to just give a 50-minute talk. She wanted to engage, be more engaging. So
I had her as a student. Robin, she asked me enough questions. Now it's my turn to ask the questions.
Yeah, you can put her on the spot. Okay. Well, thank you all for joining us. I think it was an important evening and helping us to prepare for elections in November. So I appreciate the time you took to be with us and your comments and opinions have been great. So, and finally, thank you, Steve. And I'll be in touch with you another time. So.